Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's March 2022, and this is episode 280, which is a spoiler-filled conversation about the 2021 Oscar-nominated film, The Eyes of Tammy Faye, which is currently streaming on HBO Max. It has received two Oscar nominations, one for Jessica Chastain for Best Actress and the other for Best Makeup in a Motion Picture. Today's guest is Cole Burgett. He is a recent seminary graduate and also a graduate of Moody Bible Institute. He is an author for the website Christ and Pop Culture. Cole has written an online exclusive film review for the Christian Research Journal. His article is called Tragedy and Delusion in the Eyes of Tammy Faye, and you can read his review for free at our website, equip.org. Now, normally, our exclusive content is only available to our subscribers, but we are making this film review free in light of the Oscars coming up on Sunday and also to give you a taste of some of the exclusive content we have on our website. If you do not already subscribe and want to have access to this exclusive content, please go to our website, equip.org. Future Melanie here. After we recorded this podcast about this film, The Eyes of Tammy Faye, Jessica Chastain, who plays Tammy Faye Baker in this film, won the Best Actress Award for the Screen Actors Guild back on February 27th. Now, she was super surprised. I think everyone was very surprised that she won this. And it made her suddenly the front runner for the Oscars, which are happening this Sunday on March 27th. Now, you might not be anyone that cares about Hollywood or Screen Actors Guild Awards or the Oscars. However, when anyone wins an Oscar or a SAG award, usually that film gets more promotion and visibility. So because of this, and because it is a depiction of a historical time in evangelicalism, this film, The Eyes of Tammy Faye, will be seen by more people, especially because it's available streaming on HBO Max. So I just wanted to point out that it is going to get a lot more promotion and a lot more visibility since her SAG win, and possibly if she wins the Oscar on Sunday. So now back to the podcast. Cole, it's good to have you on.
Always good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, today we're going to have a spoiler-filled discussion, as I said, about the 2021 film, The Eyes of Tammy Faye, which has received an Oscar nomination for the lead actress and who plays Tammy Faye Baker, and that's Jessica Chastain. But first of all, I wanted to mention that this is one of these biopic films. You know, those are the kinds of films that dramatize the life of a person that actually lived, and they're not documentaries, but they're quasi fictional, like maybe created. There's some artistic license that they weave historical events around, or sometimes it focuses on maybe a particular season of somebody's life, like the other biopic film that has a Best Actress nominee, and that's the film about Princess Diana. So we're about heading into Oscars, and it's going to happen this Sunday. And so there are several Oscar-nominated films that are more in the biopic category, including the one about Lucy of I Love Lucy TV show, the Princess Diana one that I mentioned, and also a film called King Richard about the father of Venus and Serena Williams, who are professional tennis players. And this particular film is about the life of Tammy Faye Baker, and its title is based on a 2000 documentary. So it's keeping the same title as an actual documentary, but kind of dramatizing it. So that's really fascinating. And so I just want to ask, you know, it's been a lot of years since Jim and Tammy Faye Baker, who are one of the most famous televangelists in terms of Christian ministers on TV. And so a lot of people probably weren't even born when they were going through their travails. And so for some of the listeners who don't even know who these people are, why don't you give us a little context to the story? Who exactly were Jim and Tammy Faye Baker?
Yeah, so Jim and Tammy Faye Baker were Assemblies of God Christian televangelists who capitalized on the medium back in the mid-1970s through the late 1980s. Their extremely popular television program called the PTL Club, short for Praise the Lord, became the flagship program of the PTL satellite network, which is still in operation today. And in fact, after his release from prison, that teases where this story goes, Jim Baker purchased the network's trademark and relaunched it fairly recently, actually. Anyway, the Bakers were pretty hot back in the day. They were considered the Ken and Barbie of televangelism, known for being quite different from the usual Christian fundamentalist preachers who denounce things like homosexuality, for example. But things really took off in the mid to late 1980s when news broke regarding fraud and sex scandals that the Bakers were caught up in. Now, the exact circumstances regarding all of this remains a little nebulous, but the basic facts are that Jim Baker and one of his associates, a guy named John Wesley Fletcher, had a one-night stand with Jessica Hahn, who was then paid close to $300,000 in hush money. Now, Hahn alleged that Fletcher and Baker raped her, an allegation which Baker denied. But after all of this came out, Baker resigned from the PTL club, and Jerry Falwell Sr. Took over PTL. But after allegations that Baker had had other homosexual encounters, Falwell barred Baker from ever returning to PTL. And in the midst of all this, news began to break that Baker had frauded donors out of millions of dollars, most of it used to cover operating expenses at his 2,300-acre Christian theme park called Heritage USA. Baker was indicted on charges of mail fraud, wire fraud, and conspiracy in 1988, and convicted in 89. He was sentenced to 45 years in federal prison and made parole in July 1994, having served not quite 5 years of that sentence. He was released in December of that year, owing $6 million to the IRS. Now, where does Tammy Faye, his wife, fit into all of this? Well, she didn't really take much of the legal blowback, but she did end up divorcing Jim in 92, and she remarried the following year, a guy named Roe Messner, who's also a character in the film. Tammy, at the time, was known for her really extravagant appearance, lots of makeup, that kind of thing. Later in her life, she published some books, and she was known for being an ally to the gay community. She died in 2007, and Jim, meanwhile, has since returned to televangelism, more or less doing the same shtick, and currently owns the relaunched PTL network, but it certainly doesn't have the audience that it did back in the day. So that is a very quick overview of the historical events that this film dramatizes.
I think it's fascinating that they made a biopic of this, of the documentary, so many, you know, years later, 20 years later, this movie comes out, because it's very far removed a little bit from the events. It's certainly not ripped from the headlines because it's been about 20 years. So the Bakers in particular, Jim and Tammy Faye, they advocated a specific kind of what we've come to know as like ministries, that what we've come to know as kind of name it and claim it theology, which is still around. It's word of faith theology. And as a matter of fact, our president of the Christian Research Institute, Hank Hanegraaff, has written one of the seminal books about their theology called Christianity in Crisis, if anyone hasn't already read or heard of that book. But I'd like you to give an overview of the Word of Faith movement for people who don't know about it and why it has a certain problematic theology that specifically the Bakers really leaned hard into in their television ministry.
The Bakers really helped to bring to prominence this televangelism medium and really helped to popularize this late 20th century movement known as Word of Faith. And what this teaches in very general terms is that Christians can manifest their desires through faith by speaking it. So the idea, as you said, of name it and claim it, for example, is an expression straight out of this idea. And theologically, this kind of movement roots itself in the idea that God desires for his children to never have to suffer for their faith, and that he wants them to be both physically and financially prosperous. Now, it's important to understand this is not just a be healthy and make a living concept, but there are no bounds here. God desires for all of his children to have more, always more, more money, more excess, and it's all wrapped in this language of blessing. So any kind of suffering is then actually from the devil, and anyone who experiences suffering, be it, you know, physically, financially, or in relationships, whatever it is under some kind of spiritual assault by Satan. So that's some of the Word of Faith theology in a nutshell. And of course, the specifics of this is going to vary from adherent to adherent. But when you look at it systematically, these are the general similarities in beliefs. The specific flavor of theology you'll sometimes hear this referred to is prosperity theology, the idea being that basically good health and a large disposable income are a good indicator of God's favor on one's life. This theology is mostly found in Pentecostal and charismatic circles, though it's worth pointing out that many within those movements would disagree with its tenets. So names like Oral Roberts, Kenneth Copeland, Creflo Dollar, Joel Osteen, T.D. Jakes are just some of the more well-known ones who have popularized this movement going into the 21st century. And that's the Word of Faith movement in a nutshell.
Well, it's interesting. Word of Faith theology has been around for a very long time, way before the Bakers. But it's interesting that this film portrays how they, it's kind of a light bulb moment for them because they think, wow, you know, we've been going from church to church, but what if we could get on TV? And so I think part of that is this film shows Tammy Faye kind of coming to this realization and encouraging her husband, Jim, in that direction. And it's really interesting because the film itself portrays Tammy Faye as being very earnest and really believing in God, very, you know, faithful about, oh, let's go out there and preach and believing all these kinds of things as she's in Bible college. But at the same time, she comes across quite shrewd as well. So she has this weird kind of juxtaposition of naivete because she uses this very high-pitched voice to speak and to do like little baby voices in their early puppet ministry days. And yet she seems really shrewd about wanting to use TV as a medium to get their message across to more and more people. And it seemed to me in the film, the way the film portrayed Tammy Faye as a character is that she seemed to believe what they were teaching the audience. She really did believe in the prosperity gospel. And I wonder if she understood what, you know, you mentioned their downfall when we started this podcast. I mean, did she really realize what she was saying on air in terms of asking people to give financially, sacrificially so that they would be blessed? And yet here she was having this lavish lifestyle and living in these large homes and certain things like that. So it's interesting to me. And when I said that she also has this shrewdness, there's a scene, and I don't know if this really happened on PTL or there's similar types, but there's a scene in the movie where she confesses to a sin and she just starts crying and pouring her heart out about how hard marriage is and would Jim forgive her? And all of a sudden it shows all the phones lighting up and they're just making all these donations. So I'm just wondering, what do you think it compels like people to watch their whole entire, you know, performances kind of, it seemed like to me, and, but not just watch them, but really resonate them with them. In other words, when they had certain pitches, like when Tammy Faye in the film is confessing sins, all of a sudden they just, you know, really feel compelled to give financially to this ministry and especially to a project, like you said, they were building this big entertainment kind of complex out in Fort Mill, South Carolina.
I don't know that we can ever really know someone's motivation without them just outright, you know, telling you. And if you want to take something like that at face value, I mean, who knows what she knew in the moment. But one of the things the film does well, I think, is suggest that it could go both ways. Is it all an act or is there something earnest there? I mean, the truth is probably somewhere in between because that's reality, which is oftentimes, you know, contradictory and paradoxical. And that's just how humans are. Like you mentioned, it's a weird juxtaposition that the movie really digs into. She's very shrewd in one moment and very naive the next. And the film, to its credit, I think, shows the complexity of someone who is actually quite delusional, but is completely committed to this delusion and earnest in the delusion. And that's part of the tragedy of the whole thing. As far as what compels people to this, to a degree, I think that's fairly obvious. I mean, who doesn't like the idea that God wants to give you lots of stuff? The notion that poverty or financial or physical hardship is an indicator that God is not blessing your life, I mean, that's a very compelling idea, especially when it's being preached by someone, for my money, it really is incredibly earnest and open and honest and buying into this. And, you know, when you look at her life and the clothes she's wearing and things like that, you can see that it's kind of working out for them in a sense. We are very much a culture consumed by consumerism. So you can see how these ideas really catch on in a modern American context. But to the question of of support, where people actually give money to this kind of thing, that's where things become a bit harder of a sell. Because what people like the Bakers preyed upon was this notion that if you give to their ministries, that is faith in action, and God would reward that. So if you give $10, you get $100 back from some blessing God would enact for you somewhere. Those are hypothetical numbers, by the way. In truth, Jim Baker got pledges from people in the thousands of dollars with the promise of resort hotel stays, and that's the kind of stuff that got him convicted. But you get the idea. And what's more, and this is the part that has always been the most disturbing to me, is how these teachers will warp the context of Scripture to fit their warped theological ideas. So there's no exegesis here. There's no letting your theology arise from the teachings of the text. It is full-on eisegesis in taking your theological ideas and dropping them onto the text and then warping the context to fit what you're trying to say. So, for example, they'll take the miracles of Jesus and suggest that those miracles are a template for what one is to expect out of life. Now, there's a real problem of hermeneutic that is remarkably inconsistent if you try to read the Bible that way. The feeding of the 5,000, to get specific for just a second, in this framework thus becomes a story that is meant to give the reader an expectation for abundance in their own life. Gone is any recognition of the purpose of Jesus' miracles to the nation of Israel as evidence to them that he is their Messiah. So you're not just cutting out the historical context, but more importantly, you're just missing the literary context. Well, technically, I guess you're moving the literary context. You're suddenly saying that the point of the narrative, like and the other miracles Christ performed, has nothing to do with the continuity of Scripture's narrative in demonstrating Jesus of Nazareth as the Messiah to a specific people group at a specific time in history. And the gospel writer's point in recording it is to convince you, the reader, of one, what they themselves witnessed as a testament to his messiahship, and two, to convince the reader that Christ alone is their means back into right standing with the Father. None of that is in view. Instead, the point of it becomes a template for what you can expect out of the Christian life on this side of eternity. And I think it really catches on because people don't actually read the Bible. I mean, Jim Baker has even come out and said that before prison, he had never read the Bible all the way through. It was just sort of picking out these sections that served the purpose of his ministry, and he went with it. Well, then you don't have context. Now, I'm not demeaning anyone who hasn't read the Bible entirely, but when you just jump into a text that you're unfamiliar with, you're really losing a lot of important context. This is why you don't just pray, flip open the Bible, point, and start reading. I tell my students that all the time. If we watched movies the way that many people read the Bible, we would start the movie, watch 5 minutes, fast forward to the halfway point, watch 10 more, skip to the end, and expect to have any clue what's going on. I mean, this is why Revelation is a book that's so hard for people, because it has all of these Old Testament references. It has all of this Old Testament language and imagery. I mean, Revelation talks about Gog and Magog, which gets a passing mention in the early part of the Old Testament, isn't talked about again. It's absurd. And when you have people that detached from Scripture, which I would say is the vast majority of the church today, these people who just sort of, you know, spot their way through the Bible and try to pull a cohesive theology out of, you know, zero context, you're going to get people who get blown around by every wind of stray teaching out there. And it's something to be wary of. But in light of all of that, it's absolutely no surprise to me that these ministries prosper. These ministries like the ones that Jim and Tammy Faye Baker advocated for, it's no surprise to me that these ministries prosper when people don't know the text of Scripture.
We are running another giveaway, and the entry to this giveaway ends on June 30th, 2022. And what you are getting, if you win this giveaway, is you are getting a complimentary subscription to the Christian Research Journal, which is all the printed journals to your doorstep. Plus, in addition, you receive all the online exclusive content because you will get access to that. Now, if you are a U.S. resident and you win this giveaway, you get the additional 4 books. You get Doubts About Darwin, which is a very in-depth book by Thomas Woodward. You get 2 books that are the best of the Christian Research Journal. Both of these books are hardcover. One is called What is Truth? The other one is a book about ethics called Whose Ethics, Whose Morals. And of course, we always cover cultural apologetics here on this podcast. We are throwing in the book by Paul Gould, Cultural Apologetics, Renewing the Christian Voice, Conscience, and Imagination in a Disenchanted World. Now, to enter, it's really easy. All you do is you go to Apple Podcasts and you write us a short review. Why do you like to listen to this podcast? It's the only way that really we can track all of these entries, because we will call out the username of the person who wins. And so we thank you for that. And you can also help us out by subscribing to our journal. This is really important. We're trying to build our subscription base, and a subscription is $33.50. But if you just want all of the online exclusives that we do feature on the podcast, you can subscribe monthly for $4.99 or annually for $24.99. Nine or for $33.50, you can have the online access and the print edition. So thank you for getting the word out. And another way you can help us out, if it's not in your budget to do any kind of subscription, and that would just be simply give us a tip. If you give up a coffee or two out at your favorite cafe for a week, you can give us a tip. Go to equip.org, go to magazine at the drop-down menu. You'll see Postmodern Realities Podcast. Just click on any of the landing pages and you will find a link there where you can leave us a tip. And thank you for helping us get the word out about this content and for supporting and partnering with the Christian Research Journal. You were talking about just the prosperity, literally, of the Word of Faith movement. And I'm wondering what you think about how it has evolved, because it really was an electronic medium that really carried it to huge prominence in American culture, and how it keeps growing with the rise of, you know, social media culture and 21st century. Right before this podcast, I looked up Joel Osteen is one of the biggest proponents of Word of Faith theology now. And he, you know, one of his signature taglines is live your best life now. And he, you know, Google can be trusted, but according to Google sources, he's worth more than $100 million. And he has over 4 million, almost 5 million, you know, followers on Instagram. So he is very popular and people want to hear about this. And as an aside, I want to tell our listeners, we have a really in-depth dive into manifesting that's coming up in our print issue, volume 45, number one, written by Ann Kennedy, because that's something I've noticed is not just Christians, but non-Christians are really big into manifesting right now, to speaking your truth every day, to believe, if you say out loud that I'm going to be happy and healthy and wealthy every day to yourself, then it will come true. So how do you think, you know, maybe the tools of the 21st century has continued to carry this message on?
Yeah. So very quickly, to your point about being even secularized now, I first encountered this fairly recently, actually. There was a coworker who, one of my secular jobs, who said something very similar. It was kind of like, and it's funny because it triggered all of my theology bells. And I was like, I didn't know you were a religious person. They're like, oh, I'm not. And I thought, oh, okay. But it has become secularized. You're right. And this was a new experience for me. But as far as how the movement has evolved, especially with the rise of social media culture in the 21st century, it's worth pointing out that just televangelism in general is still quite popular with the likes of Joel Osteen, as you mentioned, T.D. Jakes and Joyce Meyer. Sure, these people have churches that most of them broadcast from. You don't really see a lot of the in-studio stuff like the Bakers were into, but it's still there. You might run across it on TBN, for example, which Jim Baker actually helped to establish. At least that's what my research showed. But with the rise of social media, this stuff has taken on a whole new dimension in that it's accessible to everyone now. So anybody who has a thought can project that thought to the world via a live stream. Look, I'm from the mountains of Eastern Kentucky, to give an example. And there are some folks I know back there who hop on Facebook and do a whole live stream every time they have a dream and proceed to interpret this dream as a vision from God that's meant to minister to other people. Now, they're not asking for money or anything, but the point is anybody who has a phone or a computer with an internet connection can put their theology out there, really without even the support or oversight of the church. So it's certainly fair to say that social media and the rise of influencers have changed the texture of the Word of Faith movement. I mean, in some ways, you could probably even go as far as to say that these early televangelists like Jim and Tammy Faye were the original influencers, considering their very widespread appeal and the kind of advertising and talk show stuff they were doing.
So I want to talk a little bit more about the film itself. And because we've been talking about Word of Faith theology, does the film position Jim and Tammy Faye as really being particularly theological? In other words, does it give any kind of insight or critique to this Word of Faith theology as they showed little snippets of them preaching it, you know, and holding up, there are a lot of scenes of Jim holding up a Bible, you know?
As I kind of mentioned earlier, the film really doesn't present things as being one way or the other. The film is really a character study of Tammy Baker and all its complexity. And you get the sense that she and Jim maybe at one time believed the stuff that they were selling to the world. Maybe their life together started honest and genuine enough. But as success and fortune came their way, the line between faith and fantasy began to blur a little bit. I mean, the film certainly positions Jim as being the schemer here, and I think that's fairly accurate. And Tammy is sort of being a victim of her own greed and the naivete that we mentioned. When, you know, who knows how much she knew at any given time? This is the stuff that people speculate on and have speculated about for decades. But at the end of the day, it's all speculation and motivations are complex. If there is one thing this concept called postmodernity has taught us, it's that human beings are quite complex, and there's often multifaceted, even contradictory motivations at times. And I think the film does quite a good job of showing that, at least regarding the character of Tammy. As far as like critiquing their theology, there is very little of that going on. However, as you mentioned, there are some important scenes in there that has them reflecting on the morality of basically asking people for money to fund their lavish lifestyle. The character, if there is like a counter theology or a theology or a conversation of theology that goes on in the movie, the character who sort of articulates a counter theology is Tammy's mother, Rachel Grover, played by Sherry Jones in the movie. Rachel comes in at different points of the narrative to really question Tammy and Jim's motivations. She does this from the moment, you know, Tammy shows up on the doorstep with this guy that she's married to. And it continues throughout the film. And she is sort of the one character who you get the sense genuinely loves Tammy in her own, you know, stern way. But she's also the one character who is never quite hoodwinked by the extravagance of it all. The film is bookended by scenes of Tammy as a child who maybe cheats her way into the spotlight by pretending to have a very powerful religious experience. And it's Rachel who is quite stern and has her own flaws, but looks at the situation and doesn't fall for it for a minute. You get that really, it's sort of comical, but it's actually kind of profound scene where Tammy brings Rachel, this is when she's an adult, she brings Rachel out and she takes her shopping and gets her this really, you know, outlandish sort of fur coat. And even while wearing it, Rachel's like, this is absurd. Like, this is well beyond the bounds of reason. But by the end of the film, you find out that Rachel had always kept the coat. I think it's implied that she never wore it, but she always kept it, because it's something that her daughter had become successful enough to buy for her. So you get that really, for my money, really well done moment where it really is a mother's love, who she really does care for her daughter, but she doesn't fall for the tricks for a minute. There's not a lot of theological exploration here, and that's just not what the film is about. You get some dialogue between Tammy and Jim towards the end, questioning the morality of what they're doing and whether they were wrong to do what they did, but really that's about it.
It seems like they had these force of personalities. The only other scene that I could think of in terms of questioning their theology is very early on in Bible college. I guess Jim is giving
with the professor. Training. Yeah.
And he starts saying, you know, God wants us to be happy and to give us things. And Tammy Faye is like shown being enraptured. And the Bible professor says, wait a minute, what about the teachings of the poor? And he just insists, no, you're wrong. This is what the Bible's about. So it kind of shows their early force of personality for sure.
Yeah, I forgot about that scene with the Bible professor, which was actually quite well done. I that was my first fear as I was watching the movie is, oh my gosh, this is a Bible professor, so they're going to turn him into a caricature of all Bible professors. And he really kind of wasn't. He actually articulated a good point. But you see how even in that scene, Jim and Tammy sort of become enraptured with the rebelliousness of the other. It really is a kind of narcissism where, you know, Tammy's watching this guy who kicks against the grain as much as she did as a child and as much as she continues to do. And they sort of get caught up in each other as two people who have a rebellious streak. Again, that's the thing the film does really well, is it you're watching it and you're going, is this genuine affection or is this full-on narcissism and they're just falling for each other because they're so, you know, darn similar? And it really is almost valid to read it both ways.
Well, speaking of theology, you know, I noted in this film that Jerry Falwell shows up in the film, which is interesting, and he's part of their history because I don't usually think of Assemblies of God people and People Who Manifest and Southern Baptists.
Southern Baptist.
Don't run in the same theological circles by a mile. So, you know, why did their paths cross? And in the midst of all of the history of Jerry Falwell becoming involved later in their ministry when it was imploding, did that mean that Jerry Falwell endorsed their theology?
Yeah, Falwell's an interesting wrinkle in all of this. First of all, I found Vincent D'Onofrio's portrayal to be quite hilarious. The Baptists in this film are portrayed almost like Christian gangsters, like scheming in these dark rooms with people in dark suits. And it's an intentional caricature, and it's quite funny for my money. I thought it was hilarious. But Falwell's involvement comes because the PTL empire really begins to grow and attract attention from just conservative leaders in general. The film skins it as Falwell is a little competitive with Jim Baker, which, from what I can tell, is consistent with what's documented historically. Now, Falwell would eventually oust Baker and take over PTL after all the scandals, which was significant because, as you noted, PTL was an Assemblies of God venture and Falwell's a Southern Baptist. Many people believed that it was just Falwell looking to take over a very lucrative business. And the film does get into that and really gives you a good glimpse at the political side of ministry, which for anyone who has spent more than just a couple of days in Christian ministry, you know, is a very real thing. You know, it's one of the reasons I will absolutely keel over before I work in a church proper setting. I absolutely refuse to do it. I can't stomach the politics of it. And I'm more than happy to just attend a church service, but my involvement sort of stops there and I have no qualms about it. You just can't get away from these political games, especially in modern American culture. And the film shows the high end of this sort of stuff pretty well. I'm thinking of the scene where they're on the golf cart and they're talking about, you know, securing the president's election. And it really is comical. It's like, these are gangsters now. And sure, you get the sense watching the movie that it is a bit cynical. Falwell is far more interested in jockeying for political gain than he is anything else. But he is also presented as very committed to his ideology, which, you know, demonizes pretty much everybody who isn't a fundamentalist Christian. That's what this film does. It paints in caricatures with some of these larger personalities to really highlight the absurdity of the whole situation. Regarding what Falwell actually believed in all of this stuff, I mean, look, this is the guy who went down a water slide at Jim Baker's theme park in a business suit. Like, this stuff is just outrageous. It really is comical. And you're sitting there wondering how any of this was reality. And the film didn't even show this, the water slide thing, but you can actually see pictures of Falwell on the slide in a suit for a fundraiser or something like that. It's just so, so bizarre. And we forget that this stuff was just out there, and the truth really is sort of stranger than fiction at this point. I don't think he bought this prosperity theology, this word of faith stuff, but, you know, he clearly was involved with them to one degree or another, and it really is just bizarre stuff.
Yes, that is humorous. Anyone can Google Jerry Falwell going down that water slide in his business suit, full with his tie and everything. So another thing that the film brings up is the fact that all these years later, Tammy Faye is considered an icon for the LGBTQ community. And the film itself explores her connection to it towards the end of the film. And it's interesting because 15 years ago, I guess, before she died, in the year she died, actually, 2007, RuPaul, who also is a drag queen who has this Emmy nominated, I think it's might even won, I don't know about that, show called RuPaul's Drag Race. He interviewed Tammy Faye on his talk show. And not only that, he is actually the narrator of the original documentary, The Eyes of Tammy Faye from 2000, on which this film is based. So she is kind of seen as like a Christian person who champions, you know, the gay community and being a person of faith and being gay. So it's interesting. Why do you think she's considered an icon for that community?
Yeah, it's my understanding that Tammy Faye was always, you know, an outspoken supporter of the gay community. The film positions her as being quite taboo in this regard, standing up to Falwell. Actually, this is worth pointing out. Let me digress for just a minute. Falwell is presented in this film as being quite militantly against gays, which perhaps in the 70s and 80s was accurate. But later in his life, he did go on record supporting LGBT civil rights. And I think there's something to that. You know, the only problem with painting in caricatures to make a point is that you run the risk of losing some of the complexity. And in this current cultural climate, the idea that someone can actually divorce religion from politics, or to use an older expression, to keep church and state separate, is odd. The notion that an evangelical can look at a practicing homosexual and say, I don't agree with what you're doing, but I support your civil rights, is almost a foreign concept to a lot of people. And the fact that Falwell later on could actually do that and did do that is worth mentioning. Anyway, back to Tammy Faye. The film presents her affection for the gay community. And I thought this was like really interesting. As not necessarily coming from a position of pure altruistic love for the other, it sort of blends her suspicions about Jim along with her history of being rebellious and her willingness to stand up to people like Falwell, and says that that all sort of swirls together to provoke her to reach out to the gay community. But it is worth noting that in reality, she really is sort of remembered fondly by the LGBT people as someone who really was an ally to their cause. And if she has a lasting legacy that goes beyond, you know, the PTL nonsense and all of that, it really does seem to be her advocacy for gay rights.
So in your review, you talk about the fact that it was probably intentional by the filmmakers to portray the character as being superficial. You know, why do you think that is? I mean, how does the film itself, you know, have this balance between tragedy and comedy in some of their situations and how they view the subjects themselves?
Yeah, so when you get past the absurdity and you know, the comedy of all of this stuff and really look at it, it really is tragic in a lot of ways. And we've talked some already about the comedy of all of the stuff, especially in, you know, the Falwell and the Baptist gangsters, and in a lot of how, you know, Tammy and Jim interact. At some point in the review, I think I say something like it's downright Shakespearean in some ways. And this is where I sort of think that some of the secular reviewers misread this film, where there is a kind of superficiality exhibited by both Jim and Tammy Faye, and that is very intentional. I think this film, as much as it is a character study that doesn't really excavate the motivations of its characters so much as suggest certain possibilities, is actually quite subtle in how it handles people who are not very subtle in how they lived. And you can see that by how these moments in the movie sort of just explode from out of nowhere. Like the scenes that deal with sex, which aren't showing skin or anything like that, but are actually quite explicit and not subtle at all. You can tell that another type of film would have really wallowed in this stuff. And this film does not. And it's a testament to the superficiality of it all. Jim and Tammy are called the Ken and Barbie of televangelism. And this film really mines that comparison for all it's worth. They're as fake as plastic dolls, but that intentional superficiality makes a very apt point. That there are actual people who are that fake. There isn't much depth there. Tammy comes across as naive in life, as she is shrewd in business. And that is the tragic dimension of her character. She's as superficial as her makeup, but is committed to that. And I think you noted at one point that it was sort of like watching a train wreck. And that's a very good descriptor, I think. Watching this movie really is like watching a train wreck. And the comedy sort of makes it an easier pill to swallow. But you look at some of this stuff and you look at some of the absurdity of it all, and it's almost like you can't look away. You go, how on earth was this real?
Before we move on, and you just mentioned a few moments ago about some sexual situation scenes. Now, this film is rated PG, and it does go over, you know, evangelical television preacher history. Is this, do you think, an appropriate movie for teenagers, young teens to watch?
Did you say this film was rated PG?
13. PG-13.
Oh, okay. Okay. I thought you said PG. I was about to fall out of my chair.
And what I meant was, you mentioned something about sexual situations and contemporary church history. So is this something that Christian families could watch together?
That's an interesting question. We text some about this because about 10 minutes into the movie, there were a couple of scenes and I was thinking, oh my gosh, if this is 10 minutes in, where does the film go? Or are we sure we're going to do this movie? I would not feel comfortable watching a scene like this with young adults, or watching a movie like this with young adults. There are some scenes in there that, like I said, it's not really showing skin, but it is actually quite explicit. Those are areas where the film is not subtle at all. To press into this for just a second, I actually kind of think it's intentional on the part of the filmmakers. I think that's done quite intentionally because, it's meant to show the absurdity of these characters, where you have two people who really do come across as naive children who just all at once suddenly engage in these, you know, kind of explicit sexual activities. And there's absolutely no subtlety or nuance to what they're doing. And it's supposed to catch you off guard. It's supposed to make you sort of flinch and go, oh, I where did that come from? And the fact that the culture is sort of numb to those kinds of things says a lot about where we are. Because I think it's supposed to highlight the inherent weirdness of the whole thing. It is, as you, to use your word, a juxtaposition. You're juxtaposing two characters who really are operating out of, or they at least project, a childlike innocence, who suddenly are doing not very childlike things, and they're not at all subtle about it. And it's almost goofy to watch. But it startles you, and I think it's meant to startle you.
Well, what's really interesting is at the beginning of the film, one of the troubling, I guess, stories that Jim tells, they're going on like a picnic date at their Christian Bible college. And he says, can you keep us, like, have you done anything bad ever, Tammy Faye? And she's like, no, I can't think of anything. And she asks, well, how about you, Jim? And he tells her this story about having some urges and not, you know, doing things he shouldn't have with a young lady, which caused him to crash his car, which caused some kid to almost die. So he prayed that he wouldn't. And when the kid didn't die, you know, dramatic pause, that meant that the Lord had set him aside for a bigger purpose. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, you see Yeah, and I don't know if that's apocryphal. I don't know if that actually happened.
No, I don't know. I mean, they're taking some artistic license with it, but I find it's interesting. I don't know.
Yeah, it is interesting. You see a lot of that stuff sort of marking the stages of the film, where at key moments, things like that happen, where just when you think one of the characters is on the precipice of, you know, stumbling way over into something wrong, they sort of, or their life is about to crash and burn. It's usually Tammy who, you know, prays this very childlike prayer, and, you know, things, what she thinks at the time sort of kind of works out. And you're looking at it and you're going, so do you genuinely, you know, is this a genuine thing that you're doing, where you're actually praying and you're believing what you're saying, or is this just your default in a moment of desperation, because it's all you know to do? And again, you don't know in that moment if he's sort of manipulating Tammy into liking him by being, you know, really vulnerable when he really shouldn't, if the story is even true. You just don't know. And that's part of the slipperiness of these characters, is you kind of lose sight of just what's true and what's real as you're going through the narrative. Just like I think they sort of lose sight of reality as they get caught up in the extravagance of their lifestyle and the extravagance of the, you know, the millions and millions of dollars.
Well, in your review, you know, you note the connection, you know, between childhood trauma and religious expression, that you say that the film, you know, is astute in observing that, specifically, I would say, in Tammy Faye's life, because it's focused on her. And you also note that you have a mentor who's fond of saying, we don't pull our psychology into our theology enough. So what does that mean? And how do you think that this film demonstrates that in particular?
Yeah, this is something we really do need to get better at doing. As you mentioned, I have a good mentor and friend who has made this point countless times, that the church needs to get better at pulling psychology into theology. And working in the realm of ministry that I do, I can say with no small amount of certainty, it's a good point to make. When dealing with convicts on a daily basis, you really start to see that people, no matter how well-intentioned, really do have psychological blind spots. And those are usually the reasons they end up in prison. I mean, it's the things you don't know about yourself that ultimately cut your throat. That's what makes stories like Shakespeare's tragedies and stories like The Fall of Jim and Tammy Faye Baker so compelling, because there actually is a very timeless lesson in them. As much as I'm a happy fundamentalist most days, a lot of conservative Christians, both evangelical and fundamentalist, tend to ignore a lot of good psychological research to our detriment. But the film makes a good use of this, as you noted, and it actually shows Tammy's childhood and how the need for attention and the willingness to do whatever it takes to get that attention from her mother, especially, as well as the attention of others, it really follows her throughout her life. And at key moments in the film, she goes back to this scene from her childhood. The film is bookended by clips from her childhood. So it really highlights the significance of these moments and how they follow her into adulthood. And so you really get the sense regarding her and Jim that they are two people who desperately need to be the center of attention. They are sort of perfect for each other in the worst way. You know, when you meet, you know, two people and you think you two deserve each other because they compromise in similar ways, that's the key. At no point are they ever shown to have friends outside of each other, especially early in their relationship. They're really infatuated with each other in a way that is probably a little narcissistic. It's the scene you brought up in the Bible college where Jim is preaching and he knows he's preaching in contrast to what the Bible professor wants, and Tammy is sitting there enraptured with him. And you're going, well, is she really, you know, taken in by what he's preaching? Or is she just, you know, enraptured at the fact that he's willing to, you know, almost, you know, just give a middle finger to the system, so it was, to throw off the rigid conservative way, which is exactly what she had done in her childhood, and that's exactly how she was under her mother's roof. Is she really infatuated with him, or does she just see something like her in him, and it really becomes like a narcissistic kind of thing that they fall for each other? The undoing of these characters is written in the stars from the moment they meet. And, you know, in hindsight, you can't really see this ending in any other way but as a train wreck, as we've said. You sort of wonder, and the film leads the audience to wonder, and you really start to ask if Tammy herself wonders if any of it was genuine. She was genuine in the delusion she created for herself. The film will suggest that Jim was far more the schemer who knew that he was being dishonest about things. But Tammy, you sort of get the feeling that the film suggests she was victimized. She was sort of ruled by this fixed delusion. And within that, she was a very sincere person. It really is, and I use this word in its most literary sense, it's pathetic. I mean, she really is a pathetic character in the truest and most literary sense of the word, which contains dimensions of pitifulness and tragicness. And the story really is a tragedy, and all great tragedies are deeply psychological.
Well, it's interesting because you get to the end of the film and, you know, you're asking yourself how you should feel about people like Jim and Tammy. I mean, I don't think you just leave with such mixed feelings when you watch it, and it is based on, you know, history. They did recreate some of the actual intros to the Jim and Tammy show and some of the performances that she had when she sang the Battle Hymn Republic and so forth after their downfall. And so you ask yourself, well, have I just gone through a 2-hour long con by these guys? I mean, are they con artists? Are they truly, do they believe in God? Are they Christians? And, you know, I also wonder about why this film was made, just because we live in such an anti-Christian, post-Christian situation right now. So anyone who can be portrayed as just, oh, one of those naive Christians, or here they are again trying to fleece people from money, you know, that's how the culture sees Christians. And so I guess, and also, as we talked about at the beginning of this podcast, you know, you talked about the errors of Word of Faith theology. I mean, how do we really ultimately look at these characters when some of this stuff happened 30 years ago? I mean, there's a lot of, you know, a history in the rearview mirror. And although Pat Robertson, who's a character in this movie, is still alive and well and on his network doing the 700 Club. But I mean, Jerry Falwell Sr. is now deceased and Tammy Faye Baker is deceased. And of course, you mentioned Jim has kind of reinvented himself doing the same stuff that he's done before, but with a different wife. But do we ultimately see them as insincere, con artists, not really true believers? Where do we put them? What category are they in, really?
You know, this is the big question in a lot of ways. What on earth do we do with people like this? It is worth pointing out, like you said, there are scenes in this movie that are actually recreation, shot for shot, of stuff that the people actually watched on television in the 70s and 80s. And that is that's quite a huge, you know, realization to have. And it is, you're right, it is such a weird movie to be made now. Why of all films is something like this made? And I do think that it shows that the culture is actually quite interested in religion and spirituality, whatever you want to, you know, skin that as. So there is an undercurrent of this stuff out there. It's perhaps not as mainstream simply because a lot of the larger production companies and studios aren't going to gamble their money away on producing something like this. But there's still some stuff in the culture that draws you to it. I mean, the Exodus film came out a few years ago, and that was a huge retelling. A terrible retelling, but a huge retelling of the Exodus story, and so there's an appetite for it. To your question of how should we approach these people as Christians, like Jim and Tammy Faye, you can't readily accept the delusion, and you most certainly can't buy the theology, and the gut level reaction is to recoil hard because of the level of deception that went on. But by the same token, the absolute worst thing you can do, and I really do believe this, is to look at two professing but horribly misguided Christians and tell them, well, you're not really a believer. I don't think followers of Christ are ever given that right. You have to understand that these are not people out there denying Christ. These are people who claim to embrace him. And Christ's own instruction to the disciples in the parable of the wheat and the tares is to let them grow until the time of the harvest, to not go around trying to tear up the good from the bad, because they're going to get something wrong and tear up the wrong thing. That at the time of the harvest, the reapers will do the sorting. And you know, there's a really good reason why the Lord judges the heart and you and I don't. Thank God for that. Ultimately, I think there has to be a healthy degree of objectivity. And you have to call the delusion and the bad theology for, you know, for the crap that it is. And that's really what it is. But you also have to remember that these are people who were very likely at one time quite sincere in their faith. And if the Apostle Paul did not believe that it was very possible for a Christian to royally screw up, he would never have put pen to paper. Let me say that again. If the Apostle Paul did not believe that it was possible for a professing Christian to turn around and royally screw up, he would never have written a single word. Because the vast majority of his letters are addressed to churches that contain professing Christians who have made serious theological errors in their thinking, leading some of them to do very bad things. And the purpose of those letters is to teach, rebuke, correct, and train in righteousness. And I say all of this to say that we have to be careful in assigning motivations to people, especially to people in a fixed delusion, because it becomes quite difficult to separate sincerity from condescension and putting on airs. I really do think that Jesus Christ must have felt very deeply for Tammy Faye, as he does for people who sort of trap themselves in this very warped delusion that the purpose of faith is to give one what they want on this side of eternity. Because that thinking defeats the purpose of hope, which is a very critical component of our Christian religion. So I think you have to reject the false teaching. You have to recognize the false teaching for what it is, reject the false teaching. But we have to be careful in how we think about the people themselves, how they're conducting the false teaching. We have to reject it, but by the same time, by the same token, I think you work toward restoration with those individuals.
Well, finally, on a much lighter note, we always have some fun rapid-fire questions for our authors. And so today, Cole, apples or oranges?
Depends on my mood. I'm going to go with apples today.
And speaking of Heritage USA, have you ever been to a Christian theme park, a Holy Land experience in Orlando, or the Bible Museum in Washington, D.C.?
See, I've been to the Creation Museum, and that's sort of like a Christian theme park in some ways. But I did not even really know that the idea of a Christian theme park existed until I started, you know, researching some of this stuff. And the Heritage USA, I was like, is this a real thing? Sure enough, it was. So no, not in that sense. I have never been to a Christian theme park. And, you know, for the record, I don't know that I ever will.
Well, thanks, Cole, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to episode 280 of the Postmodern Realities podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was Cole Burgett. He has written an article that is a film review of The Eyes of Tammy Faye. His article is called Tragedy and Delusion in the Eyes of Tammy Faye, and you can read his article for free at our website, equip.org.